Accession number 10081, reel 4.
Explained to me the problems of signals in Trones Wood.
Yes.
But bearing in mind, you know, that you were in the Somme area from July to October, were there sort of general problems of signals that you can remember in that particular area? When you look back, can you think of any particular set of problems you might have?
No, you see, we relied upon the old, what they call, in the front line, what they call the D3 telephone. Our object was to get telephonic communication to, if you were a company attacking, to get it back to battalion headquarters. The battalion headquarters would send that back to brigade, you see. That was the line of communication.
And did you manage generally to keep that going?
Well, yes.
Throughout these areas?
Well, we always had a number of men who were called linesmen. I wasn't a linesman. I was an operator because I was very good at Morse and getting, you know, messages down quickly. And the linesman would be ready if the line broke to trace the line through. Frightful job, you know, especially with the mud and filth and that. Then they had to just repair the line.
Were there particular problems in the Somme area, you know, with the mud, do you think, when the bad weather set in?
Oh, yes, because to try and repair a telephone line when the trench is full of water and mud, you see, you have to follow it. Our linesmen with their hands, you see. Although we had a little idea of which way the lines were moving, we tried the trench. But of course, before the actual Somme, we were digging what they call cable trenches for the Royal Engineers. They were the Royal Engineers signals. They were the big men at the back, you know, corps headquarters and that.
Yes, I think you did explain earlier.
Yes,
you know, your preparations.
Very, very shallow, deep trenches to put cables in, but they could only go a certain distance forward, see, as far as brigade. But there was something in the back of my mind, I'm trying to think. I'd start from the beginning. A signal would come through to battalion headquarters. Somebody in the back corps headquarters, someone like that, wanted identification of the Germans in front. Well, that message filtered through to the front battalion, and then from the front battalion to the front platoon. And the next thing, the cry was, volunteers for a bombing raid. Bombing raid to go and try and pinch one German soldier. That's all they wanted. So intelligence at the back could interview him and find out what regiment it was, you see. And the bribe, of course, was if you volunteered, you got a week leave. You see, they gave you a week's leave. Some of the chaps volunteered for... God, faces are all blackened, you know. He used to black their faces and all that kind of thing. They were brave chaps, they were. It was mostly bombing raids over there. They were really bombing raids, because they'd sneak through the wire, find out, try and cut through the wire, if they were not to find a dugout, and then throw the bombs down, you see. And very often... the sentry would be caught. See, they're after a sentry, that's what they're after, you see. And they used to bring them back sometimes, because the poor Germans were scared stiff, they're only too glad to go back.
If I could ask you now about, you know, you said after the Somme, you were sent to Bailleul, was it?
Bailleul?
Bailleul,
yes.
And what actually happened there to you?
We just kept the line. We didn't do any attacking. We were simply defending, because he was trying to break through. He was trying to break through to the big town of Harsbrook. That's what he was after. And he didn't get through. Because they rushed us up there, even after the song, we were dead tired.
Thing was the move to the Hindenburg line. Yes, could you tell me about that, Mr. Brown, and when it would have been?
We were sent forward it was Easter Monday, and would you believe it was snowing hard, and it was not a very nice part of the French terrain, because there was no shelter at all, and poor wounded, the colonel sent down to the horse lines, bring up every available blanket. The men were lying on stretchers. It was so cold, Easter Monday. And
What area would this have been?
Well, it was just Neuville-Vitasse. You see, he shortened his line. That was the idea. So although it was part of the Somme, but he was making the line shorter, and this was the Hindenburg line. But my gosh, the trenches were marvellous where I saw them.
You actually went up to the Hindenburg
line? I was in there, yes, when we got through. Beautiful. I've never seen trenches like them. Oh, beautiful. Lovely deep dugouts and everything there. He was trying to save troops, you see, getting shorter troops. He wanted to shorten the line. That was the idea. But anyhow, on the Easter Monday, we kept chasing him. We were chasing him back to where he was going to make the stand, you see. But the poor wounded had an awful time to get them back. And frightful country. There was no cover anywhere, no towns anywhere. And
how far do you think you pushed the Germans back?
A long way then, because he was falling back. In fact, our front line troops didn't know he'd gone back at one part, till it was suddenly very quiet. Then, of course, they knew that he was retreating on purpose. But that's the day I saw a German on the side of the road. He had a machine gun, and he's facing the road. There's only one main road through there, funny part about it, and everyone had to use this road. And he must have trained his machine gun straight down the road to catch our fellows. But somebody must have caught him, because he was a wonderful German. I've never seen middle aged too, marvellous chap. He looked well cared for and everything. He was killed lying there by his machine gun. He had his machine gun trained on the road, you see. But what happened after that?
Did you call it the big stunt? You know this.
Well, I think it's just, they used to call stunts in those days, you know, now it's only the soldier's expression of an attack. These two men, one was Gray and Max, and they were both linesmen. And that's how they came to write this little together. They got together this lines of poetry, you know. Do you want me to read it?
Oh yes, I think that would be very interesting.
It starts off, it's the scene, the front line near Neuville-Vitasse. The hero, a linesman considered first class. The victims, three men and an NCO. They tramped over and over. The language did flow. The faithful drum, the drum is the wire drum, reeled steadily out. The victims paused. They were in doubt. Who knows where is this blinking station? They were trying to find a signal station. And the signal sergeant then was Sam, and he was, everything that had to be done was for the colonel. And Sam says here now, so as the poem goes on, my colonel wants communication. And it goes on, when someone comes this tale to tell, old Sam on the right of Mercatel. Mercatel was a village near Nervilleville House. Old Sam was the signal sergeant. You often read such things in fiction, but never was heard such malediction upon the head of one so great. That's old Sam, you know. Rained thick and fast the hymns of hate. Communications at all costs, Sam murmured. He could not be lost. Then after further communication, the victims turned in desperation, consigned the hero, that's old Sam, down to hell, and turned their backs on Mercatel. I don't know what made them write, but those two were always writing bits of poetry. It's funny, you know. They used to write them on the front line, even when the shelling was on. They used to write between themselves. They were nice fellows, too. Yeah.
That sounds as if you might have had a few problems with communications going up towards the Hindenburg line.
Yes, yes.
Is that right?
Yes,
laying the lines
yes,
and getting...
Yes, see, there was... were moving so fast they hadn't time to get some of the telephone stations, but he was moving back so quickly, you see, and that's why the old Sam was supposed to know where the station was, and we couldn't find it. So that's why they got so fed up with it. But it was a form of open warfare, you see, because he was moving back all the time, but he knew where to stop, you know.
Yes, it's interesting you talking about the Hindenburg line, because obviously you looked at this later on, did you?
Yes.
It would have been at a later stage.
Yes, yes.
Did they have good living conditions in that line, do you think?
Oh, much better than the British. Oh, yes, the trenches were marvellous. Deep trenches.
And dugouts.
Very high pyramid, yes, very good dugouts indeed, yes.
And did you see anything about their sort of sleeping and eating conditions there?
Well, we, at one period of, I don't know when, but we came across, I think it was Prince Rupert's headquarters.
What were they like?
Yes. He had electric light down there. He took the beds from the French village. He brought the furniture in. And they even had electric fans working down there. It was more like a hotel on the ground. But of course, Sir Douglas Haig wouldn't have that, you know. Mind you, Prince Rupert was a very high... But even in the front line, their dugouts were deep, much better than ours. Of course, the German engineers are good. Yeah, yeah. Our chaps, very often, they had to sleep outside and cover themselves with a waterproof and that.
Mm-hmm. But what do you think also, Mr. Brown, about the positions, their positions? Were they better than the British, do you think, generally, the German positions?
I think their sighting trenches were better. Yes, they always seemed to be on top of a hill or something like that. Well, take the case of the town of Ypres, look at that, you see. As I said, you couldn't move all day, no. As soon as night came, everything's moved. Then, of course, he starts his shelling then when the night comes down, trying to hit the rations coming up. Because I remember one case, I've lost the trend now, but we were talking about Ypres, where one time the rations come up as soon as it gets dark. Usually the transport officer would lead the train up. And this particular night, he got off his horse and the horse ran away, and he was asking for volunteers, would somebody go and try and find, because it was a lovely horse he had, you know, and they sent a man in Ypres. He said, I'll go and try and find it. We never saw him again. Don't know where he got to.
I think you said also that you witnessed something of the Battle of Arras in spring 1917, didn't you? Am I right there? You were.
Well, that's Arras, isn't it?
This is when you were in reserve. This your position, was it, Arras?
Yeah.
When you went forward to the Hindenburg line.
Yes.
So would that have been during the Battle of Arras as such? That
I think it was called the Battle of Arras. I wouldn't be sure.
Yes. Did you see anything of the gas at that time? that was used?
We were very, very lucky. The only gas I saw was when the...
At this time, I'm thinking, in spring 1917.
Oh, this is going back to... I'm going too far
yes,
ahead.
Yes, I think you have... Yes, too we leave ahead. That, if too you don't mind, because I think you've covered but that elsewhere.
We were not long at the Battle of Arras. We were not long. We were pulled out.
I think you told me earlier you were in reserve there. Is
reserve,
that right?
Yes.
Did you see anything of what was happening?
No, I didn't see any Germans. And there was very little shell fire, funnily enough, because we were following him up, you see. And he was trying to get back as quickly as possible to his the Hindenburg line. That was to be the main line there.
I think you also told me that you were at Ypres at the end of the Battle of Passchendaele, weren't you?
Yes,
of 1917.
Yes.
You know, when you first went up to the area at the end of the year, can you remember your initial impression of it?
Scared stiff.
Were you? Why was that? What was happening?
Because we had guns on every side of us. We never knew from where it was coming from, because it was a salient. The whole April front was a nightmare. And this particular, we took over this particular part of the line, and I don't know what they hold. Some farmers have them where, are there these ice things? Louis, go down. And that was our company headquarters. We went down with a ladder. And if he'd have come across and attacked and dropped a bomb down there, we'd have all gone. But luckily, instead of attacking frontally, he attacked on the side and missed us. But it was a terrible, dismal place. And we had a dog there, couldn't get rid of the dog. They sent a dog up to carry messages. But you mustn't feed it. But the chaps were giving a bit of scraps now and then, so, you know, couldn't get him back. I had to chase him away with stones to back to there.
Yes, was that usual, you know, to use dogs in that situation?
No, I think it's just the powers that be. We're just trying to find out, because you couldn't keep any telephone lines working there, you see. It was, they were smashed as soon as they were put down, you see. Wireless hadn't come into it then. Although we did have a machine later on called the Fuller phone, after General Fuller.
I think you explain about that
continuous,
later on.
Continuous.
Yes, you do explain that later on.
Yes.
But, you know, apart from dogs, did you use pigeons?
Yes, pigeons. Oh, they're very good pigeons, yes.
This was at Ypres,
yes, I had a basket of pigeons, yes.
Mm. Were they effective?
Yes, we used to clip the message on the leg, you know, and send it off. And the pigeon men were at the back on a trailer with where the birds knew where to go. They were behind the line, yes.
And did you also use rifle rocket messages?
Yes, we tried an experiment with a rifle rocket, but it was so it was so good that it hit the fellow who was trying to watch for it coming down. But they didn't do that much later. It was supposed to be fired from a rifle, but it didn't come off very well, really. Oh, they tried all kinds of things. Communication, you see, the ground was so terrible up there. It's just mud and filth and that. Anyhow...
Did it make your sort of living very difficult, to try and...
You were never clean. And then a lot of the men had this lice, you know. That was terrible. Funnily, it never affected me. I don't know why. Because they used to have these... not a nice thing to say, but they used to take their shirts off and put the candle. Eggs used to get in the seams, you know, the seams, the army shirts and that. But I think the authorities did all they could. They used to have divisional baths, you see. If a division got out of the line for some time, everybody had a hot bath. Because they take over the local laundry or something like that. So they did their best, you know, really. And very often there was a stream or a bit of river the men used to go and bathe and that kind of thing. But it was but I'll never forget coming back to Bayeul, back again, when I was in the signal station, the doctor's house, we could only allow a certain amount of drink because you might do something silly, really. And the shops were full. You know, good. All the shops had just been left empty. And the fellas were sending underclothes home. They hadn't had a change, and some of the men were dressing into ladies' things.
Yes, I think you mentioned that a bit later on, and we'll leave that if you don't mind.
And some of the men were sending parcels home, too. Yes. I don't blame them, anyhow. But if you slipped on the duckboard, you could sink right down, right up to your neck almost, you see.
Yes, did you see anyone, who lost their lives in that way?
No, funny thing, I didn't see many fatalities in the... because we were just behind the front line. But of course there was he had pill boxes, you know, in those days. See, there again, he was in front of us again. See, those pill boxes. But of course, when we got to the pill boxes, of course the door was the wrong way. The door was at the back. So we had to go in through the back door at the front, you know. And he was watching us all the time then, you see.
Yes, I think you now go into pilgrimage.
Yes,
don't
yes, pilgrimage, yes, yes.
Yes, I think we'll go to do that now.